Okay, so we're here today with Michael Gaynor again. He's running on an independent line for mayor of the city of Buffalo on the Restore Buffalo line.
That is correct. Round two.
And so I want this to be a continuing series of conversations with the candidates. And at a broader level, what it's really about, is what I'll say, is it's about the health of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so each different time we'll sort of focus on something different that, that relates in a way to that. What I want to focus on today is how the city works or does not work for the people who live here, for the citizens. And part of why I think that's important is I think at every level of government, from the national level down to the very local level like this, there's broad dissatisfaction with how our governments actually operate for us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's creating some real swings in how people vote. I mean, I would say that, obviously Trump is related to that. People would say Mamdani is related to that kind of, this kind of outsider that comes in and is a big upset, was really a repudiation of Cuomo and the status quo. And certainly happened in Buffalo previously with India Walton. And,
yes.
What there was against her was a very well-financed and organized effort to make sure, not that Byron Brown won, but that she didn't win.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this has been happening for several years. And what I want to do with this conversation is take that forward. Where do we go from here? And to start it, I think a really simple way to start that is to have you tell me or tell us one specific problem in the way that you see that the city operates, or maybe there's even some good things that you see, mm-hmm. that you can identify, but identify a problem in how the city operates, really in the interface between City Hall and the people who live here, and how do you actually change that? Because I think that change is incredibly hard, and then we can sort of dissect the roadblocks of that as we go on.
Right. Well, of course, you know that I'm going to talk about the Humboldt Parkway in this conversation, so I have to use that as an example because, as I talk to more and more people, every issue that comes up, can be tied back to the same types of challenges that we've encountered on this Humboldt Parkway. And I got involved in this race not because I desire to have a career in politics, but because as someone that has been engaged on the community level, solving problems, trying to create initiatives, starting businesses, founding not-for-profits, doing things to bring people together, right? To build community, to figure out what challenges we face as a community and how we can close the gap on those challenges to bring more service, more connection, more of an intention to the way that the way that people live on a daily basis. And that's what I've been doing for 20 years, and still I, someone that has been in that position, someone that has the capacity to bring things together, write grants, start organizations, feel like I'm on the outside looking in. And I've had conversations just in recent days where we're losing citizens, we're losing community members, we're losing assets because they feel like they're not heard, that they're not supported, that they don't have the ear or the attention of City Hall. And these are people that are doing transformative things, that have skills and resources to bring to the table, that have talents that they want to contribute to their city. And when we have regular citizens that are in positions of that have capacity and have educational experience and have technical expertise and that are committed daily to this city and making it a better place, feeling like they're not heard, then how does a regular person feel on a daily basis that's just raising their family and wanting to have a healthy neighborhood or another playground or a park feel? Like, that has been my frustration, is that I have brought millions of dollars of outside resources to this community just by sheer will and intention. And I can't even get a meeting with economic development and planning to talk about how we can train young people or how we can improve and beautify vacant lots. And not even that, Not even is it just not getting a meeting. It's almost like a conscientious effort to undermine the work of people that are doing good things. Because the right people aren't getting money, or the right people aren't getting attention, or the right people aren't getting the credit, right? So that's just not what we need in terms of having a healthy, functioning, democratic community and city. And that's not how we take a city that's currently struggling to the next level. We do that by engaging all of these people that are change makers in this community. You know, when I was inspired by, you know, the people that I was reading about on, to be honest, Buffalo Rising back in 2005. Like, that's what got me engaged, was seeing the work and the engagement of the people around me. So we need to have a strategy. And it starts with having an intention. Like, the next leader of Buffalo needs to have an intention to mobilize and elevate these ideas and to bring them to the forefront of the conversation and how we think about solving problems in the city. If there's not an intention to engage with the community, if there's not a focus and effort and resources put behind supporting business leaders and supporting community organizations and groups that are trying to transform commercial districts or neighborhood blocks, then it doesn't happen. And then people get discouraged, they get apathetic, and then they just give up. And like we've seen on many neighborhoods across the city, people that just have given up because they have tried and they've gotten nothing in return.
Yeah, there's two things or components of this. One is at a state level, and then one is at the city level in this, you know, this example that you bring up. Mm-hmm. And so, and even the city level, I think, has multiple components of, I would say, problems in or issues with where we are with the 33. One of them, I think, has been this feeling, and is that there was, I remember when I was, you know, had a job and what ended up being, I fell into what was corporate America, and I was told by the human resources manager at one point that I had to pick a side. They felt that I was too much on the side of the employees when I was in management. Mm-hmm. So that you got to pick a side. You're going to be on management or you're the employee's side.
Right.
And in all the years that I've since been involved in real estate and different facets in Buffalo, one of the feelings that I get, and it's in some ways a little bit understandable, mm-hmm. is that there is an adversarial relationship between the way city employees treat people in the city.
Right.
And if you take, like, so there has been this, I would say, for a long time when Buffalo was declining and houses were falling apart and the neighborhoods were falling apart, that was in some ways their role. It was kind of like they were treating all these abandoned houses, these absentee owners, all this stuff as something that you had to go after.
Right.
And part of what I feel like is that mindset has kind of in some ways never really changed.
Right.
Right. That there are these two camps. So that's one component of it that you could comment on. The next one is that I think comes down to planning. And I just think that we think so small here.
Right.
We just think so small. There is no I don't even think we should be talking about the 33.
Right.
Like that is one component of a larger traffic plan that needs to be addressed for the city of Buffalo.
Right.
So let's take both of those things,
mm-hmm.
and pick one of them first. So let's say this, the mindset of City Hall. You know, I think one of the things when anybody studies organizations or leadership or anything, and you can tell it when you go into a business, like, and you go into a business and the staff is really great and they make this, they're like, oh, I'll give you that for free because they messed something up or whatever. That's a management level decision,
right.
That's encouraged their employees to behave right. in that way.
Right? Right.
So I believe it is top down.
It is.
But how do you change that when you've got this sort of decades of entrenched right. behavior and mindset?
Well, I think that you said it very, very eloquently, which is it is top down. Like it is the culture of any workplace. Like there is, you know, to toot my own horn, there's a reason why my company has retained the same employees for the last 20 years. Because we have a culture of care that that respects employees, that listens to employees, that empowers employees. And it doesn't always work out perfectly. You know, there's conflict and there are issues. But at the end of the day, it's never personal, right? It is about always delivering a quality service, a quality job, a quality outcome to our constituents, our neighbors, our customers, whoever it has to be. And I think that has been a culture that we've worked on as a community at Buffalo Reuse and at Reuse Action, at the Foundry, even within the Humble Parkway organizing community, that is transferable to how we set up culture and how we do business at City Hall. And I think that what we see coming out of City Hall are these indications that things are really a mess. Like when you see, public service workers that make a really catastrophic mistake, and then you find out that they're not even licensed properly, and their co-pilot in their vehicle was on his cell phone, or you see police officers traveling at 80 or 90 miles an hour, jeopardizing the lives of community members, and we see these symptoms, which are these huge lawsuits and settlements that cost us tens of thousands of those are all symptoms of a deterioration of culture and a lack of pride and dignity and respect for the work that you do each day. Because if you show up every day committed to deliver a high level of service to your neighbors, to your constituents, I mean, these are your neighbors. These are your community members. These are the businesses that you shop at. Like, this is very much the heart and soul of what we call community here in Buffalo. If you're not showing up with that attitude and that intention, then the whole you start to get these symptoms that build up, and they accumulate over time, and it comes at the expense of that very same community that you serve, and I think that's. The biggest reason why I'm committed to running is because it will be a transformation. And that's not to say that we're going to disrupt and throw everybody off the ship. But it does come with setting a new tone for how we conduct business, how we treat people. I've often been on the receiving end of people that I can tell they're not bad people, but they're unhappy with their job. They're unhappy with their day-to-day. That's not a fault of theirs. It has to do with the culture. I'll bring up CJ Vallone, who runs Duval Safety. One of they were many years one of the best employers because they had a culture of care for their employees. CJ always had a willing ear. They did things as a community. They took breaks in the middle of the work week and played foosball and had picnics and created a community approach to their work and their life. It gave people a sense of purpose and care for the work that they were doing every day. Those are things in many different respects that can be incorporated into life at City Hall. And they're very feasible and they're very low-hanging fruit. And, you know, I've had conversations with people that have been at City Hall, right? And are invested in that work and have those ideas on how to make it function better. Like, they're like, well, why can't you get a contractor to do? There's a lot of contractors that have just closed the door on doing business in the city of Buffalo because you're disrespected. Nobody answers the phone. It's hard to get a license. You get the runaround. You get four different answers. Like, that's been going on for 20 years. And even the work that Rich Tobey did when he was the commissioner back then to try to expedite and streamline it, those efforts were tangible and real, and they've redone the permitting process now, and it's almost a one-stop shop where you can go on and make a permit to make it easier, but it still has to be a whole philosophical paradigm shift in how we think about operating government and how we treat people each day with that care and intention. And I have to be honest with you, I've lived in 12 cities in this country, and I haven't seen that as a dominant philosophy on how city governments work, which I know that there are challenges. I'm not so naive to say that to think that it's going to be easy, but it does start exactly with what I say, is articulating a vision and articulating a culture that you want to see as the dominant paradigm for how we conduct business each day. And then from there on, it becomes about how we listen to communities and how we engage communities and how we pull people in and how we're really serious about doing that. Not just paying lip service to it, not like doing all the work and then dropping ideas in their lap. Like literally pulling the intelligence and the wisdom and the perspective from our communities that actually works its way into a master plan for Jefferson Avenue, or works its way into a master plan for Abbott Road, or Parkside, Riverside, or the downtown corridor. Because I'll tell you that in every one of those instances, people feel like they're ignored every day. They've got ideas, they're doing their own thing, they're trying to make their home, their neighborhood stronger, their commercial districts more vibrant, more vital, and they feel like they're operating in a vacuum without the support that they need. And so, that's not going to continue.
So how do you actually, like, nuts and bolts, attack this once you, let's say you're mayor?
Yeah.
What are the things that you would have to do to start this process?
It's going
to
start with an impeccable leadership team. You know, the people that serve at the pleasure of the mayor, the commissioners that that serve as heads of all of those departments.
And how many commissioners are there?
Well, there's a commissioner of public works, permits and inspections, community services, fire, police. What am I forgetting? There's more. Real estate. Obviously, the clerk's office, the comptroller is an elected position, but you know, there. Citizen services. So there's a team of about 12, 10 to 12 commissioners, higher level officials that serve at the pleasure of the mayor, and they're going to be the people that are empowered with the responsibility of creating that culture and setting that tone for each department. And that's not to say that everybody that's currently serving at City Hall goes out the door and new people come in, but they have to at least be open-minded to and receptive to a different way of performing their jobs and conducting business. And they have to be receptive to a platform that engages communities, that really embraces the assets and the resources and the capacity that we have here, and is willing to leverage those in creative ways to get things done. Like, if you're like, well, if you're the type of person, and I've trained these type of people because I've brought in lots of carpenters, you know, that have 20, 30 years experience. If they're the type that are just like, well, this is the way I've always done it. And I was like, well, that may be true. But if the way that you've always done it isn't effective, you're not going to continue to do that. We're going to do it this way. And if you're willing to be nimble and creative and do it a different way, then join the team. And I think that that's where you start. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, just since this race has changed, since Scanlon has dropped out, the people that I'm talking to are a growing and more diverse group of people than I have had conversations with in the past. And I think that's because they now see that there's an opportunity for a real transformation. We don't need to just resign to one of two machines that have been operating, that spent $2 million on campaigns, and we're still sitting here wondering, like, what's the plan? What's the vision? Because I saw $2 million go out the door, and I couldn't tell you what the long-term vision of either candidate is for moving Buffalo to the next level. And that's a loss for our community. And that's when you see where it's not about ideas, it's not about vision, it's not about long-term goals or strategies. It's just about maintaining power and control over a system that from my vantage point has been grossly ineffective.
Now, the other, to go back to the 33 plan, and me sort of suggesting that I thought we should be talking about an entire citywide transit program, or transportation realignment.
Right.
How does something like that actually happen, and how would you, like to me, I think we need to, like, go backwards and say, we were talking about the 198, nothing happened. We're talking about the 33, and that's still up in the air. We've never really had a conversation about the 190,
right.
And we've never had a conversation about the fact that the red light system in the city is
Terrible.
Yeah. At best.
Let's just start with that. Terrible. Yeah. I mean, I will tell you this, that I put in my action agenda, you know, to remove two urban highways. And then I was driving down Niagara Street, and, you know, it was the night of a debate that they held at the up on Amherst Street. And I was like, you know what? I haven't been through Black Rock in a while, so I'm just going to just drive up the street. And I got to the, you know, the debate a little bit early, and Lena and I took a drive up Niagara Street. And I'm just like, when you drive down Niagara Street, right, you know, north of the north of Ontario there, and you see that view of the river and how fabulous it is, you know, you have to modify the action agenda and say remove three highways, you know, because it's just, you know, now that's not going to be my talking point throughout the campaign. But I think that what we have to be willing to do is thinking about the long-term health and vitality of the city as an organism, not just a neighborhood, not just a street, right? Which is why it has to start, the conversation needs to start. And I might be coming into office a little bit late to be able to enable this full effort, but we have to be able to think about, like, okay, these urban highways were built for a reason, I get it, but how essential are they today? And, you know, there are lots of cities. I mean, I was just meeting with Pastor Lane today, and he was like, you know, there are no highways in Amherst. The town of Amherst is almost the same population as the city of Buffalo. You know, there's transit and there's Niagara Falls Boulevard, and they're commercially vital streets with a lot of economic activity, and nobody's saying, let's build a highway here. You know, I don't really love those streets. They're not inviting to me. They're not, you know, there's lots of red lights that you sit at. But I think that what it forces us to do is actually think about and consider what does our community look like without urban highways? How do we move people around efficiently? You know, Bill Breezer, I was just talking to him the other day, and he was like, how fabulous would it be to have an activated Beltline system that moved people on a light rail type of system? Like, these are the types of ideas that if you're willing to entertain them in the context of what does our city look like in 50 years or 20 years even, then these become possibilities. But when you look at the city as an organism, not just as, you know, three highways and some people and a handful of businesses, it's like, how does the whole system grow and evolve and become more healthy and become more dynamic and be more attractive to people? Like, I spent a lot of time in Toronto. Like, aside from that's how many people are Toronto? It's 4 million or more. Yes. And there's literally just highways around the very perimeter. But once you're in the city center, you're in the city center. Like, it's, you know, I spent many, many times, many, many weekends, and I never got on the Gardner. I was just shuttling around on your bike, but there is a system because there was intention and thought behind how to move people around. You got the subway to go north and south. You got streetcars to go east and west. You got, you know, thought out bike lanes and transit routes for pedestrians and for bicycles and all kinds of things that make the system work. And it works in an efficient and effective way. Does that mean that you stop recreating or rethinking? No, but you have to have that intention to think about the whole system and how you grow it for the future. And I don't see highways in urban areas in Buffalo's future. I don't see those as vital to who we are and what our identity is here in the city of Buffalo.
So you brought up this thing that Bill Breezer had said, you know, about doing a beltway, which, you know, really exists already, right?
That's what he's saying. An existing, and, utilizing the existing right of way.
And, you know, what the light bulb that went off in my head about that is, and I was going to bring this up before, but, you know, one of the great things about Buffalo is, A, we have this old existing infrastructure of a much larger city that is enviable to a lot of new cities.
Right.
Right. That we have the Albright Knox, we have a Philharmonic, we have the Olmsted Parkways, we have, you know, Delaware Park, we've got this park system, which is, you know, if you compare it to Toronto, like, Toronto does not have that.
No.
It's actually, in many ways, not a pleasant city to be in. And, And but because of the decline in the population loss, you know, there's so much abandoned space,
right.
And you can see that in a very negative way,
right?
Right. You can look at Buffalo and you can drive around and see the falling down houses and get depressed about it, and you know, vacant, disused rail tracks and all these kind of things that
right.
sort of suggest there was a greater moment. You can also flip that and say, look at that as potential. Like, look at the potential of where we could take this
exactly
city from here. And so that's what I think is, that's where it could get exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I have a feeling right now in the city, and I think that this is not just Buffalo's fault, and so this is going to be a challenge for the next mayor, whoever it is there is, you know, I can sense some, just kind of a general feeling of pessimism
yeah.
right now, which I think, you know, starts, you know, with, first off, you just open up the newspaper every mm-hmm. morning, and it's kind of horrific. But there's that, but also that, you know, for years, we were not talking about the budget, right?
Mm-hmm.
We were not, like, all these things were just kind of not discussed, and we were, so everybody was thinking, there's been so many great things that have happened in Buffalo in the last decade, you know, I think, you know, and for me, they're all the little things, the things that people have done,
right?
You know, whether it's, you know, you opening Reuse Action, you think about the little shops that have opened up and the coffee shops and
mm-hmm.
the local businesses that we could, you know, list, you know, tons of. Like, that's the stuff that's really amazing, because Buffalo has that potential where you can come here, you can open a business relatively inexpensively.
Exactly.
You can work hard, you can make things here.
Right.
And so anyway, I think how do we shift from this moment right now where I think there is this pessimism, which I think comes from the fact that everybody's bills are going up.
Right.
We're feeling like the news is even not great about Buffalo. Like, how are we actually going to, where's tax revenue going to come from? Like,
right.
how are we going to close these gaps? And so that does put, like, kind of a damper on everyone.
Sure
right?
does.
And, yeah. and then how do you, like, take some of these, flip that mindset again mm-hmm. to, like, no, let's think big.
Right.
And take this city somewhere.
Well, and I think that there's an appetite for thinking big. Like, there is, yes, I think that there is this veneer right now, particularly given what's happening on the federal level and what we've just gone through with the whole budget and 20 years of the same mayor and all of this kind of thing. But I do believe, I mean, I moved to Buffalo because I have visited 100 cities and been almost every continent. And I came here and what lit my fire was exactly that potential. Like, I saw nothing but potential. I didn't see vacancy. I mean, I did, but I didn't dwell on the vacancy. I didn't dwell on the concentrated poverty or the abandoned buildings. I saw the resource, the capacity, and the care of the people that were here. And I saw that in the first 5 minutes I was in this city. I took the bus down Genesee Street and landed at Spot Coffee and spent the next 5.5 hours, you know, reading The Art Voice, checking out Buffalo Rising, studying bulletin boards, and walking right down Elmwood and Allen Street and walking into shops and people learning that I might move to Buffalo and then giving me tours of their neighborhood, of their shops. Like, that spirit. Like, that spirit is what communicated to me, like, this place is different. I had just moved here from Boston, so obviously it was pretty stark as well. But it was that spirit and that potential. And when you talk to people, and I did a lot of my petitioning on the east side, right around the Tops Market and in the Humboldt Parkway area, because this is a big issue for me. And it was inevitably one of the first conversations or topics that were at the forefront of my mind. And I really wanted to know where people... what people felt about it. But as soon as you would mention that you're running for mayor, and then you point out, yes, I live right over here on Northampton Street, where I've been for 20 years, immediately people were captivated, stopped their cart, wanted to hear what you had to say. And there is an appetite for people to get behind something big, transformative, different, just different. Different than what they've been experiencing, which is largely neglect and apathy and a lack of action and a lack of results and a lack of responsiveness. And And I think that that's where you start. When I came here, and I back in 2005, and I was reading Buffalo Rising and thinking about how to start Buffalo Reuse and starting to talk to people and engage with people about recycling buildings, that was the first thing that came up, right? Oh, it's been tried before. It failed. Nothing's going to change. If I listened to those detractors, right, I'd probably be just working a regular construction job now and probably out, you know, in East Aurora or something, you know? It's like, no offense meant to or East Aurora. I love it. And that's probably why I would have gone there, because I'm just like, whatever, I'm just going to live a happy life and forget about the rest of the world. But no, I was captivated by the potential of that. And I had just come from a conference in Atlanta where I met this reuse consultant. And I was like, I don't even know what a reuse consultant is. But a month later, I'm on the phone with him because at that time, Byron Brown was running on his visionary platform to tear down 10,000 houses in 10 years. So I call this reuse consultant and I'm like, hey, Dave, they're going to tear down 10,000 houses in 10 years. And he's like, well, that kind of sounds like an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And that's how Buffalo Reuse started. But it's easy to get discouraged by. So how do you refute, how do you counter that? You counter that with just going out and doing it. I didn't have deep pockets. We didn't have any money. We didn't have anything. We convinced somebody to rent us a 5,000 square foot warehouse. Kevin Hayes had a little Ford Ranger. I had a beat up van, and we went out and started salvaging houses, you know, with the permission of demolition contractors and selling stuff on the weekends and just showing people that it could be done by just having a focused intention and then going out and starting. Like my whole campaign, the way that we roll out transformative change is not going to be to remove a highway or, you know, to change how we do it. It's going to be demonstrating small transformative changes at the neighborhood level that are going to happen in the first year. People are going to be able to have healthy food access in the first year. People are going to see young people working on our streets in the first year, transforming vacant lots into clean, productive green spaces. They're going to see real changes in every neighborhood of the city in the first year. And that's how we're going to build hope for how we do bigger transformative things, because they're going to see immediate action. And that is something that they have not seen in the last, well, I can only speak for the last 20 years, but in the last 20 years, because all of the action has come from people that were determined and focused to make it happen on their own, not because they were enabled or empowered or supported by city government. And that's a real tragedy, because I shudder to think what the city would look like had it had that type of leadership for the last 20 years. Because I think, I mean, you don't have to think about it. You can see these small transformations in every corner of the city, whether it's Go Green and Groundwork Market Garden on the east side, or you know, what's happened in the Five Points neighborhood, or you know, the bookstore and some, you know, programs down on Abbott Road in South Buffalo, and all of these, you know, the community organization up on Amherst Street, you know, the growth of Waterkeeper and how they've transformed and helped to clean and improve, and the work of the sewer authority. Like, that's good stuff, you know, really good stuff. But to be thinking about it as an organism and in a big way, right? How we could have leveraged all of those to, you know, increase the capacity of that, you know, is the loss that I feel, because it's just opportunities missed. But that was then, and this is now. And now we have an opportunity to do something different, right? We have an opportunity to leave behind a democratic establishment that's got other goals, and they aren't related to empowering neighborhoods. I'll tell you that. And to change the culture at City Hall and to think in a grand and big way about the future of the city. And I'm excited about the opportunity. And I'm also excited about the nitty-gritty of just getting out there and doing small projects the first year. You know, I did it by myself and my partner and my kids at summer camp planting sunflowers on Jefferson. It was a tangible thing, and everybody stopped, put smiles on everybody's faces, and everybody was happy to see it happen. It cost about $150. And an intention to do something tangible. So we have resources at this city, And when you start to do inspiring things with the finite resources that you have, it attracts attention. I mean, you know, Mamdani hasn't even taken office yet. And there, just the excitement around his campaign gives people hope that things can be different. It's not going to be transformative in the first 4 years if he gets elected, but it's the attitude, it's the perspective, it's the vision that we can go someplace different, that we can empower communities in different ways. Like, that's what brings and captures people's imaginations. And that's what we need to do. That's what we need to do in this campaign.
One of the, I mean, you brought up some of the things that were happening at a grassroots level. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me, and I've had this conversation with a few people over the years, but in the early mid 2000s, when I first got into real estate and started getting like more kind of engaged with the city, I would say, and was actually much more back then than I am today. You know, I remember all the work that was done on the West Side. Mm-hmm. And it's really incredible to think back at that time of how different the city was then. The people people now, I don't think, quite realize how bad those years were in Buffalo, how the crack epidemic really devastated mm-hmm. Buffalo's neighborhoods. But the grassroots effort of people that had lived in those neighborhoods and then also knew people who'd come to Buffalo for some, like myself too, like moved here when everybody else was leaving and got involved in trying to, really save a neighborhood.
Right.
You know, and my wife and I at the time were on the founding board of Urban Roots. And mm-hmm. just look at, like, what one little thing like that has done. Like, that was the seed that was planted.
Exactly.
The other people on the board of Urban Roots back then, you know, the first thing they did was boot the drug dealers out of the corner bodega there and shut the bodega down.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that was a major hub of drug activity that mm-hmm. went away in a night, and that was completely grassroots efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people that did that, you know, he actually got arrested by the city for mowing a city-owned vacant lot on mm-hmm. the side. You know, and so you see that, I mean, to me, that's like the perfect example of this kind of
dysfunction,
right? Exactly. Like that the citizens are somehow an enemy.
Right.
So the other thing I want to, with the 33 example that you started with, one of the challenges with Buffalo is, of course, our relationship to the state of New York.
Right.
And I think it's more complicated than I certainly don't understand it all fully, but you take the highway examples, you know, let's say it was the 198, mm-hmm. the 33, I mean, we're dealing with the Thruway Authority, right? Mm-hmm. And we're dealing with the state. All of these things have to come through the state. And, you know, it seems to me, as somebody that, and honestly, I've not been intimately involved in either one of these conversations or efforts, but that there is this, you know, the people I have talked to, at least locally, feel like that the state position is basically no.
Right.
We're going to do what we want to do.
Right.
And, you know, they've been able to, people here have been able to derail it, certainly,
mm-hmm.
but we're still a kind of a roadblock, right?
Yeah.
And so what is that relationship totally or completely, and is that possible to change?
Yeah. I will tell you that as the Skajakwita corridor is an example, is that transformation happened in the way that planning process went forward because of the feedback that then Governor Cuomo received from two of his aides that were here and went to a meeting. And they got feedback from those people that were meeting and a lot of conflict over the initial proposal that was rolled out by the DOT. And Cuomo essentially took the, was it Cuomo? I believe it was Cuomo, yeah. Took the authority to transfer leadership of that project away from the DOT to the GBNRTC. And that's what started the whole Region Central planning process, was that transformation and that shift. And You know, they made a lot of progress on that project in getting some from basically replacing, you know, I don't even know what the original vision of that project was, but to something that was more agreeable to the communities and the business districts that surrounded that corridor. So I do, you know, you can have pessimism about government in the same way as people have, right? People have, they're pessimistic about their own city and this and that, but we have to also just initiate a conversation and try to persuade them with understanding of what the long-term implications are and the long-term outcomes are. And we haven't had a seat really at the table with Kathy Hochul. We have had made some inroads with the majority leader. And of course, the senators now have access, and there's an opportunity for Senator Ryan's office and Senator Baskin's office to make those arguments too. The state is not just the governor. You know, there is a team, and we have local representatives, and we have expectations of them in starting to influence and affect the conversation about what we want for our city. And I do believe that there is some potential. And that's, I'm an idealist. I understand that. I want to assume that people have the best long-term interests at hand. But if we can deliver a proposal or a project outcome that delivers long-term economic benefits, that leverages money that they're currently spending on East Side Avenues to do more. Like, it will be an economic transformation in a whole, when we were just talking about redlining before this, it will transform the East Side economically and from a private investment standpoint, and unlike anything that we've ever seen since that highway was built. And I think that that is the compelling argument for why we do it differently. But it starts with intention and being willing to listen to the people and respond to what the people are saying. And I think that you will see, because of the work of Eastside Parkways and because of their community outreach and because there's now a whole coalition of organizations and entities, you know, it's the PPG number one plank for this year is, you know, the restoration of the Humboldt Parkway. That was voted on by almost 100 member organizations. And that there is power and strength and numbers that we need to leverage to affect the conversation and what becomes, you know, it's not just me. If I just stand up in a vacuum and say, I think we should restore, if I didn't have 5,000 individual conversations over the last 4 months with Eastside residents that are echoing the same sentiment that we have been talking about as it relates to this project, if I didn't have the confidence of that, then I'd say, well, you know, we tried, you know, but the people don't want it. They're content with a tunnel. I can't change people's minds, but when people believe to their core that that highway is counter to having a healthy community and a healthy neighborhood, that it is a detriment to the commercial vitality, to the health of our communities, to the long-term prosperity and wealth building of that neighborhood, then you start to think, okay, everybody is on the same page with this. We just have to convince three people to get on the bandwagon. And it really is. It comes down to the majority leader, our senators, and the governor. If the governor has a change of heart tomorrow, we'll have a fully restored parkway in 4.5 years.
I misspoke one thing. I think I said the Thruway Authority, so it should have been the Department of Transportation.
Department of Transportation, yeah.
With that, have you read the book, or are you familiar with Ezra Klein's Abundance?
I have heard of the title. I've not read it.
Yeah.
But I will write it down right now and go.
Well, I think one of the things that's really interesting, and he's caught a lot of flack for this, and mm-hmm. you know, it's created a real political debate,
right.
Much larger than he expected. And I think one of the things that what really resonated with me about what he's saying is that we have reached a point where we're just not getting stuff done anymore.
Right.
There's so many like roadblocks and this and that and it's at some point we just need to do things. And that's part of why people, I think, are frustrated.
Right.
I think he's really, you know, hit on something, and he brings mm-hmm. up, you know, there's different examples in there, you know, about the rail in California and the electric charger network that was supposed to be built and never got built. And anyway, I think there's a lot of good lessons in there, and, you know, maybe not everybody's right about every, you know, particular thing, but it is what you're talking about. Like, we just need to do these things.
Right.
Like, we need to start making it happen.
Yeah.
And that is, that's a massive mindset change.
It is.
And it's not just, you know, you're going to have to get people on board at the state level. You're going to mm-hmm. have to get people on board, like, at all different levels to be like, we are going to do this.
Right. Yeah. And that's long been my intention. I don't talk about if, I say when, you know. And I talked with, you know, the majority leader's chief of staff the other day. I said, we are going to have a completed EIS system within EIS process within 2 years. And we're going to have a restored parkway in 4.5.
What's the EIS just from?
The environmental impact statement for this project. And that's because, like, there's a mandate from the people to do that. And because I believe that our state leaders want to, A, keep their jobs and may remain relevant here, and because it's in the long-term best interest of this community. And because when, you know, we have a transformed leadership and we start to show that we can do it, you know, every one of our efforts happened because we just started. And I got a lot of flack for it. You know, people think I'm a cowboy, or, you know, I put the cart ahead of the horse. All of that may be true. But the reality is if you can't demonstrate in small ways that things can happen, then you're just another, you know, just another big idea. Until you can put the rubber to the road and demonstrate a capacity to do something, and something meaningful, something tangible, something with a purpose. Like, you're just someone with an idea, you know? And I think that that's what separates people that are ideas people, or they call them armchair politicians or armchair or whatever, from people that are just going out there and doing things, you know? You by being involved in that Urban Roots effort, and you through starting a blog, and me through Buffalo Reuse and the Foundry, and we can list right now 1,000 people probably between the three of us that have done just those things. They're just like, you know what? This year we're gonna start a festival, or we're gonna start an event, or we're gonna start this business, and they went out and they did it, and they overcame the odds, and now there's an organism, there's a community built around those things. And that has to be the mindset. If you read my action agenda, which, you know, isn't on my website yet, but it will be, and you will say, oh, this isn't feasible. You know what? That's fine. You may believe it's not feasible, but if you don't articulate a goal or a vision or a direction, you will never get there. If you say that homelessness in Buffalo is absolutely inexcusable, and you don't set a goal to decrease homelessness by 75% in the next 5 years, if you don't set that goal, you're going to continue to have homeless problems. Every business person I speak to in this city talks about the homeless issue, that it's the worst they've ever seen it. And that's unacceptable to me, and it should be unacceptable to everyone that's listening right now. But if you don't say we're going to eliminate homelessness, or at least dramatically reduce it, it will continue to perpetuate and be a drag on our business districts and our communities and our neighborhoods. So set the goal and do everything that you can to rally the troops and make some movement in that direction. That's how the conversation has to start. If it's like, well, it's homelessness and it's out of our hands, that's a county issue, or that's a state issue. Yes. But we have a responsibility as city residents to have a conversation with county leaders and state leaders about how we leverage the resources that exist. And we have big resources and big assets at our disposal here in the city that we aren't using to address homelessness. When I first moved here, well, you know, I salvaged the Hotel Lafayette. The Hotel Lafayette was basically housing for some social service organization. The building was filled. Mm-hmm. And at some point those people got displaced. But the point is that there were people that were housed in a respectable way, in a safe way, in our city. And there are tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of vacant square feet downtown. Okay? We're going to figure out a way to leverage that available space to create homes for people. Short-term housing, or even long-term housing if need be. But it's not acceptable to me that we have resources available and it's inaccessible to large numbers of people. We'll figure out a way. So that's just one example, but and I can say the same thing about how we address kids that are out of school and out of work, how we address vacant lots in the city, how we address, you know, the quality of our public schools. Like, there is an initiative and a vision for each of those things, and there's going to be a transformation in each of those things in the next 8 years.
All right. Well, we're going to continue the conversations, and I look forward to discussing more of those things.
Right on.